Welcome to In The Frame, an exciting new podcast series where we're delighted to be touring the UK, meeting business leaders, and taking a look at the big picture of what makes businesses tick. I'm Paul Kempster.
And I'm Andrea DeLay. And together we co-head the mid-corporate business for Barclays, as well as being co-hosts for this podcast series.
Today I'm absolutely delighted to be in Bristol, where I'm joined by John Ball, Director at Gordano Support Group, and also by my colleague Steve Gamlin, the local Barclays Relationship Director. I wanted to start by saying thank you very much for hosting us here today, John. And it's a great morning. The weather outside is bright and sunny for once, which I'm delighted to see. And actually, also thank you for taking me on a tour of the factory just a few moments ago, where I learned a huge amount. And I think, Steve, you've been to this business many times, but I think it's fair to say you probably learned something as well, didn't you?
Every time, Paul. Actually, it's a pleasure to come down and see John and the team. And just remarkable how busy you are and the new things you're doing, John.
No, thanks for the opportunity and thanks for bringing the sunshine.
Well, we do our best, but I just wanted to start by asking you to share a little bit about the big picture of your business, John.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. We're a packaging company just designing and producing boxes for expensive equipment. So electronics, aerospace equipment, parts for aircraft, munitions. And over the years, we've changed that to add more value to our services and generate more services around the production boxes. And basically what we do is provide solutions now for sort of the input and output of manufacturing businesses. So we still provide the boxes for the output side, but we also have teams of people working on customer sites for the input part. So we will do kitting, warehousing, logistics support services, where we're moving parts around the UK for our customers, as well as providing the boxes for them to be sent out once they've been packed. When you talk about the big picture, I guess, where do we see things now and where do we see things in the future? And what are we focusing on and concentrating on as a business? We're there really to drive efficiencies for our customers. And what I mean by that is take out cost in areas that they may not see is the most important part to their business. A customer might be sat there saying, well, why have I got a team of people putting items into boxes? It's not really my core business. So we will come along and say, well, we will be able to do that more efficiently for you. And then we can control the supply of the boxes at the same time. So it's about driving costs down, both for our customers and I get end internally, which then in turn controls the cost that we put onto our end customers.
And I guess there's never been a better time on that point for your customers and your clients, you know, driving cost out for them during these inflationary times. I'm imagining is an incredibly attractive facet of your business.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always something that's always been at the forefront of what we do. People don't tend to think about the packaging or think about the box or think about that end for the products that we are protecting. If you're a consumer-to-consumer business, if you've got a bottle of perfume, all that design work's done up front. If you take a piece of scientific instrumentation that might be exported to China or to America, it's not necessarily at the forefront of that customer's mind. And it used to be that they would come to us and say, we need a box to ship this. We haven't really thought about it. The item may be worth £50,000-£100,000. How are we going to get it from A to B safely? And you're like, well, okay, have you got any ideas? What are you thinking about? Do you want it to be reusable? Is it just going to be a one-trip case? Does it need to be fully recyclable? And what sort of cost have you got in mind? And the normal answer would be, we haven't actually got any cost. We haven't put a cost model in for the packaging. And you sort of sit there and say, well, okay, that's a £50,000 piece of kit and we haven't got any money to produce a box. And that's where our work starts. And that's where our design team come in. And that's how we then produce a product that can get that item from A to B safely. And then over the life of our partnership with that customer, it will be about controlling the cost for that packaging and also how to take cost out to redesign it, to introduce different materials. And very much now the environment comes in to these conversations. And that is very much about looking at a product and looking at the materials available to us on the market to produce a box that can be fully recyclable or can include recycled element of raw material. And also a big thing is reducing the size of the box. Now, some of the items that we protect could be the size of this room. That's not going to be great for the listeners, but we're in a big office at the moment. You know, you might have a container that's 5 meters by 3 meters by 5 meters high, which is a big item. And in that, there will be a lot of space and a lot of air. But again, one of our challenges now is to reduce the size of that, reduce the volumetrics, which then takes out the amount of material we're using, but also reduces the shipping costs and then reduces the impact on the environment that way when it's being shipped.
So there's a few kind of themes coming out of that overview of the business, particularly environment and sustainability, which I'll come back to, actually, if I may, in a while. You work in a family business. So you have your father, who I think founded the business, and you're obviously key operational part of the business now, a second generation. Maybe just talk to us a little bit about the dynamics of working in a family business, generation to generation. I'm guessing there's some pros, there might be some other considerations as well to sort of think about. And many people listening to this might be in family businesses of their own. They might be first generation thinking about handing to second generation or second to third. So just a bit of perspective on your own experience of working in a family business.
Yeah, certainly. It's certainly interesting. I mean, if anybody watches Succession at the moment, you watch that and you sort of sometimes go, that's a bit like some of the things that we see on a daily basis or around the family dinner table on a Sunday or over Christmas lunch when you're on a family holiday. You don't ever get away from the fact that you're in a family business. And I worked in publishing in London for 10 years before I joined, and I never had any intention to come to the family business. It wasn't something that I ever thought was where I was going to end up. I mean, as a teenager, I used to help out, came on a Saturday, worked throughout the summer holidays, did all that, but it wasn't something that I was thinking, yeah, that's where my path's going to be. And when I said I was doing this podcast, I was talking to some of the people in the office, and I said, what I've remembered thinking about why did I come to work for my family business was I read a book called Closing. So it's a photography book about an American furniture factory that there was a family business and been around for 100 years. And in the photographs are absolutely beautiful, but it was just about the ruin of this amazing factory in Midwest America. And they were one of the biggest furniture suppliers, but the business had basically gone because the third generation hadn't adapted and hadn't changed and hadn't looked at the way the markets were changing and how technology was changing and how the processes of producing the furniture is changing. And at that stage, it was late 1990s, so the likes of IKEA and those types of people would have come up, and people weren't interested necessarily in the products that this company was producing. And my father took me for lunch and said, do you want to come and learn the business? I said, well, no, not really. I'm doing okay. Everything's great. I'm loving London. But I'd read this book and I thought, he spent at that stage 10 years building up this business. And I said, I'll come down for 2 years and look and see what it's about. And I moved from this beautiful warehouse building in King's Cross in London, overlooking the canal, to a porter cabin in a factory.
Sounds like paradise.
Absolutely. Yeah. And on my first day, I was thinking, what have I done? I wasn't quite sure what I'd done. But you sort of then think, okay, I don't want this business to go the way of the factory that was in Closing. And I looked at it and I spent a couple of years learning the business. You know, I started on the shop floor, building boxes, making things, trying to understand the nuts and bolts of the business. And then basically thought, actually, there's a lot more to this. We can do something different with this. We can add some more value. We can bring some more services. We can expand it. We were a £3-4 million turnover business when I started, which is a lot of boxes. And you think that at that stage, we pretty much were just building boxes for customers. We're now at this stage a 12 million plus business with 120 employees. We've got multiple sites around the UK. We've got implants on customer sites. So the whole business has changed and the whole scope has changed. The name's changed. We used to be called Gordano Packaging. We're now called Gordano Support Group because, again, one of my drives was we do a lot more than just build packaging. We supply these support services to global businesses to help them get their product out the door and around the globe. And that's very much how we see ourselves now. What's it like being in a family business? It's great. One side of it, it's fun. You know, and I think one of these big things in my life is that you have to have fun. The good thing about it is there's a loyalty there. There's a commitment there. There's a great team ethos there. My brother and my sister both work in the business. I have another sister who has nothing to do with the business. It's getting more like the Logan family the more I think about that. But there are really good things about it. And you're allowed to make a lot of decisions and you can move things forward. There's always the entrepreneurial spirit within the business, which I think when you work, and I have worked for a big corporation, you don't necessarily have the ability to do those things. I can come to work every day and I can make a difference. Now, that's cliched, but I can do something different and I can have an idea and I can say, well, actually, guys, let's just run with this. Because I think that we have that ability to move. We're flexible, we're adaptable, and that's all great, a great environment to work in. But yes, there are cons. I think, as I said, it's you can be sat at Christmas lunch and suddenly somebody will throw something at you. Have you done this? Are we doing this? What are we doing about that?
And you're kind of back at
work. And you're back in work the whole time. You don't ever get rid of that. It's a secure environment, but then there's also, as we talked about, succession. There is constant succession. things, thoughts going on in the back of your head. You know, I said there are siblings in the business. We still have that. What's going to happen when the founder is no longer involved in the business? There are conflicts, as there are in any business, but sometimes conflicts around a dinner table after a couple of glasses of wine can be maybe bigger than they would be around a boardroom table. But those things happen, and I'm sure with other family businesses, they see the same.
Thing. Families contain emotions; it's a natural thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So I think those are some of the cons against it. But overall, I said I came here for 2 years, and that was mid 2000s, and I'm still here.
I picked up a couple of points from that. Picked up the point around being in a family business, loyalty, commitment, I guess purpose. But maybe if I turn to Steve, you've been supporting many businesses in many industries over many years in the Southwest. And I know some of those will have been family businesses. Some wouldn't have been family-run businesses, more sort of corporate-run businesses. What's your perspective? What do you observe around family businesses and the pros and cons from different industries as well?
I think just picking up on what John said in terms of those conflicts, I think I don't know whether there's a sense of openness, or perhaps you can speak to your family in a way that you wouldn't speak to maybe a colleague or a board member. So I think there maybe is an openness. I've also found the majority of family businesses to be incredibly successful and resilient. And I don't know whether that's back to the responsibility, I think, that you just spoke about, and that sort of legacy sort of angle, using that book as your example, almost as a driver for making sure the business is a success from your father to you and your siblings and on to maybe the next generation. So I think from that side, I think a degree of resilience and that responsibility, I don't know whether that's been a sort of cornerstone of making them successful as a subset of all businesses.
And I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Steve, that when you work with family-run and owned businesses, it's that family dynamic that's always present in conversations with professional parties like banks, yep, lawyers, accountants, because it means so much. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. And also getting to know the family. And I think there's another client which I deal with quite closely, and they're on third generation. And I was speaking with them the other day, and I think the founder, I guess a grandfather now would be, was very gung-ho. His father became more cautious as the business developed and he got older. And now actually the third generation, whether they're going to really revert to the grandfather or take some learnings from both sides. But that particular business are in an incredibly strong position. So they've got options and they've got time to develop the business, which I think, again, is a legacy of their success, gives them options and time to consider things.
I think you're right, Steve. I think that when you are a second generation, and the founder for Gordano is still with the business and it's still an integral part and always will be because it was his baby. For myself, because you're ambitious, you have an entrepreneurial mindset and you want to take things in a slightly different way, the great thing about us at Gordano is that the founder will sit back and go, okay, you can try that. We can see how that works. We can see how that develops. And you can see there's a shared vision and a shared set of values about where you want things to go. I think from the second and third generation, and as you said, there are a lot of different cultures. So the founder has a very different culture to that second generation, because you see things, you're like, okay, well, I might do that in a slightly different way, or I've been taught a slightly different way to how I manage meetings, or how I'm going to have a team that makes more decisions. Then the founder originally may have made all those decisions. It's very much about culture for me, as my team can make those decisions. I don't need to sign off on everything that I do. I can sit there and say, look, here's your responsibilities. So I think that there is a difference in culture. I think that as a second and third generation person, the leadership may be less visible than it might have been as a founder, because again, you do tend to take a step back and let your management team run the business. But that's not to say it's not as important as that founder, because you're trying to take the business down a new path when you're trying to move it into a new era. You're trying to move things on. I liked your point about responsibility, because I think that is one thing that drives me on a daily basis. And again, this might sound slightly cliched, but when people say to me, what is it like working a family business? Why do you go to work every day? And I grew up as a boy knowing still 10, 20% of the people that still work for us. I still know them. You still walk out there and you know them by name. And we're now 120, 130 people. And I still know most people by name, but I wouldn't say I know everybody out there by name at this stage. But during the COVID and all those types of things, you sit there and you say, I've got 120 people here. I've got 120 people paying mortgages. I've got 120 people who still want to go on holiday. I've got 120 people that still want to do something with their children and buy them Christmas presents. I know that sounds slightly strange, but that's what's in the back of my head every time I get up and every time I walk in the door, that we got to build this business and keep it going and make it strong to help that. And then you also think, well, okay, I'm now employing 120 people. I want to employ 150. I want to employ 200. I want to make the community you know, help that community that I'm working in. I think that's what drives us as a family. And I think those values are there from the start. And that's what we do continue, even if we might take the business in a slightly different path than the founder might have said. Our vision might be slightly different that way. But that family business and the values of what the family business set up for to help those people is still there.
And I don't think that sounds strange at all, actually, John, from our experience of working with many, many clients who are family owned or family managed. That sense of commitment and reason and purpose, as you say, for your example of knowing many of the staff here for most of your life, probably, is what you're saying, it is a real driver for many family businesses. It gives them the energy and the purpose of doing what they do. So it's really interesting to hear. I just wanted to pick back up on the sustainability and environmental topic, but also kind of mix it a little bit and get your views on transition of business through to second generation. Over time, markets change, expectations change from your own clients, suppliers, and everything else. And we know, Steve and I know, that you are personally very committed to sustainability and to environmental improvement. But maybe just bring to life for us a little bit, what are the sort of decisions you've made within this business under your time in the business where you have influenced change, you have added value to your clients, but it's got that sustainability angle to it as well?
For me, one of the paths that I am pushing heavily down is how this business can help, you know, how we reduce our impact on the environment and also how our customers can reduce their impact on the environment. And that is a really big driver for me at the moment. Now, there are certain things that we have going on behind the scenes with separate business units and those types of things that we will be launching, which I'm not going to go into great detail here, but that's one of the pushes for us is to have a sustainable arm to the business that allows us to provide customers with certain products, certain materials, consultation services that can allow our customers to look at things and change their perspective on how the products they are using, that we are designing and supplying them. I think that everybody should be doing something to make a difference to the environment. And it doesn't matter how small that is. I think if enough of us are doing that, then that's going to make a difference. And that's the thing that I keep driving and trying to push forward with everybody in the business, is as well as the board. We're now into our 32nd year. There's been a culture that's come along with us. And I'm now trying to say, well, actually, yeah, that's the one culture, but we're now going to change. We're going to do things in a slightly different way. We are looking at various projects internally with renewables. We've just put solar panels on the roof, which will help. Now, I then come to a board meeting and I say, this month we've saved X amount of trees, because that's the data that I'm getting back. We've invested in more design team. We've invested in more software. We've invested in an internal laboratory, which allows us to do more drop testing, which was, again, a driver for reducing the size of the packs and reducing the amount of foam element that might be in a pack. Again, we can see that in the long term, it's going to help the environment, and it's helping sustainable goals for our customers. I think that from talking to customers and understanding how they're looking at it, some are very hot on this topic, some are driving it down the supply chain. Not everybody is at the moment, but I can definitely see over the next 5-10 years that it will be drive full down the supply chain too, and that it is a hot topic for everybody, that we have to be doing something. And in packaging is a big part of that. We generate a lot of waste, and that has to be something that has to be reduced and stopped. We're working a lot with certain customers on what I call closed loop packaging. So we're designing and building packaging that can be returned or can be reused over a long lifetime for the product. It's a discussion that we're having with a lot of customers is, okay, you want to reduce cost, which everybody does, which is okay. So we can build you a simple corrugated box to do that with some internal fitments. And that's great. It'll go from A to B. It will go safely, but you're going to throw it away. Now, if you've got a whole recyclable loop there and the stuff is being recycled when it gets to the far end, that ticks one box. That helps. But a lot of the time, it probably doesn't. It probably goes to landfill. But then you look at the other side and say, well, okay, you're going to produce this part for 5 years. Let's have a look at what you're doing with it. Let's have a look at your supply chain. That's both items that are coming in, that's items that are going out. And how can we design and build some packaging solutions that allow the items to come into your factory in a pack that will be better for the environment? And then maybe it's going to flow through your factory in that pack, and maybe it's going to go out the door in that pack at some point. Or it's going to go out the door in a pack that can be reused 10, 50, 100 times. And we may be able to look at a closed loop scenario to get that back round. And therefore, we're saving the environment that way. Now, that box may cost more than the one trip cardboard box, and it may be made out of a material that might not be fully recyclable. But if it is surviving over a 5-10 year period, there's an argument that that's a more sustainable solution for you. So they're the key drivers.
British manufacturing has faced a perfect storm of challenges over recent years, affecting supply chains and recruitment. So why is there cautious optimism and confidence throughout the sector? Because manufacturing firms have done what they do best and engineered new solutions to limit the impact of the issues they face. Our research delves into those challenges and the innovative solutions employed by UK manufacturers to tackle supply chain issues and maintain cash flow. Go to barclayscorporate.com and search Chain Reaction to access the full report.
I mean, it's a huge topic, isn't it? As you say, and for anybody that I would say meets you in person, they'll very quickly see you are a passionate advocate for sustainability. And as you said there, you know, within your own business, but more broadly through your supply chains and all other stakeholders that you touch. But just briefly, what I'm interested in is how have you found the journey, if you want to call it that, of actually kind of convincing almost different generations on the management team, even maybe on the factory floor, who may all have had be at different places around kind of understanding of the importance of sustainability. Your passion is great, but have you found that straightforward to be able to influence and bring people along at the right pace?
No, because I think everybody sees things in a slightly different way. I think, again, the younger generation see it, they understand it, they sort of want to do something about it, maybe. I think we all understand it. It's what people want to do about it. And that's hence why I said you've got to change the culture, because we may have done something one way for a long time. But it's like, well, okay, let's just question that. Let's just stand back and go, what if we do it this way? Or what if we put a biomass burner out the back to generate more energy that way? What if we put solar panels on the roof? We're going to generate some energy. What if we put 2 wind turbines out the front that generate energy? And these are all projects that I'm working on. And then you can start to see the difference. Like I said, with the solar panels, when you sit here and say, we actually saved that X number of trees last month, they're all going, okay, that's interesting. Didn't quite understand that. That's what we're doing. That is what we're trying to do. So it's communicating that out across the whole business, not just to the guys around the table. And yes, there's a cost benefit. So from a board perspective, there's also this level as well. If we generate enough through renewable energy, we can control our costs easier. It's going to be better from what we've gone through over the past 2 years with costs. So that ticks a box as well. But then it also ticks the environmental box. I think from the shop floor point of view, yes, they understand the reduction in amount of waste is good. So we've invested a lot in new machinery and semi-automated robotic machinery, which allows us to reduce that waste, which is great. And they can see that, and they can see the effects of that. We're working on a number of projects with some universities and other businesses on fully recyclable material that hasn't been recyclable and isn't recyclable at the moment. But we see there's a market for those types of things. Now again, the companies and the teams that are developing these are very much, they want it to go into mass market, consumer to consumer, but we're sat there arguing, well, actually, there's a business to business case here, because the customers that we have, even though they aren't buying 10,000 boxes, they still want their packs to be fully recyclable. So again, from our design team, they're getting excited about that, because they're looking and going, oh yeah, there's a different material. I need to go out and find that material. I need to go and work with that material. I need to go and work with these guys. So from that point, it's broadening their perspective and broadening their options in opening their eyes. So I think it's very much just slowly, just for me, just putting things in front of the guys, going, have you looked at this? And rather than me, things I said to you, Steve, rather than from the old-fashioned way that we've been of telling somebody what to do, I'm very much just drip-feeding info in, going, have we looked at this, guys, as a material? Have we spoken to these people? Have we pulled these guys in for a chat? Why don't we invest in this? And maybe that will make a difference. So everybody then can see that that's a key part of what we're trying to do.
John, it's great to hear that you're running towards the solutions. Others are being dragged along. But what we're seeing in a lot of larger tenders and sort of for new clients is that this is a key element of any tender. You know, what are you doing about it? What ideas are you bringing to the table? And I guess that must give you a bit of a competitive advantage in terms of your thinking, what you can demonstrate. Have you found that in your discussions?
Yeah. So nowadays you have to be, again, a bit like ISO. What's ISO 9001? There is ISO 14001, which is environmental standards. So and you have a sustainable policy and you have environmental policies. But the one thing I find with it is, to me, it's a tick box mentality. you can get these standards, but what are you actually doing behind the scenes that's trying to make a difference to that? Yes, we can recycle as much as we like, and we can use a certain amount of recycled material, but it's how do we take that step further and how do we really push that? But you're right, we have to tick those boxes first, be able to then get in front of that new customer to then go, have we thought about this? And I think when you present the customers with some of the things that may be 2 or 3 years off yet, it certainly does get an engagement in there that gives us a competitive advantage because people are sat there going, hadn't thought about that. Could we use that? This is where that big picture partnership comes in because you're sat with the customers going, well, okay, but this would be good for all of us. Because if we can get this new product into one of your packs and that pack is a success and we start to use that on a lot more of your products, that's a great thing for you to get out there and spread the word that you've done that. Now, because it's a packaging in a box, a lot of people are a bit like, oh, but it's a big thing. And packaging is one of the big waste drivers.
Just switching away from sustainability and the environment for a moment, if I may. Another aspect that we often see in family businesses with at least two generations still involved in some form of the business is the way that those businesses and management teams and owners navigate challenges in the marketplaces, the economy, society more broadly. And of course, the last few years have been challenging, I think it's fair to say, from Brexit to a pandemic to the impacts of the Ukraine war as well. Just interested to sort of hear from you about how your own business and the family really have maybe just drawn on their experiences at different generational levels to navigate through those challenges and any sort of insights or tips you would have for other businesses as a plan, the contingency plan really for unknown events.
I think it's very much how you manage it or what we term as governance, isn't it really? And one thing about family businesses, and I think family businesses to survive, is you have to have a solid governance model that you follow. And I think that's both for you as the family and as well as the people that aren't in the family. You know, people sit below us probably thinking, what are they thinking? What are they doing? What's going to happen? What's the next 5 years going to bring? So the key thing really is governance and the communication out. And then also, I think looking at the talent you have and looking at the talent both from a family point of view as well as those people that aren't in the family and developing the right talent into the right roles. And I think in terms of a governance and the way that we manage, we very much have, as I call it, a four-ring model. So we have the owner family management and we have those meetings. And those meetings can be out to dinner. They can be down the pub on a Friday night. They can be watching a rugby match. And, you know, it will just generally go into a discussion about what we're doing, how we're doing, what problems we've got, well, what do we think about that? And then you have a board. So you've got a board and advisors, which is where, again, a lot of our board is still centered around the family, but then we have professional advisors that may come in from outside, which will have a different hat on, whether they're lawyers, whether they're accountants, whether they're Steve. Now, again, just bringing Steve into that. I go to a lot of these dinners that Barclays put on because you just get different perspectives and different information from people. And then you can talk to Steve and say, okay, Steve, we're thinking about this. We might have an issue. We're all thinking about doing it this way. We've looked at these options. What can you bring to the table? Because we may be slightly blinkered in what we're looking at. So we get the advice from outside, which is good for us. So I said, we have the family room. We've got a board and advisors room. We then have a management room. So that is from what I call the guys, the girls that are running the business day to day. So that's the management room that we come in and out of. And we will sit there. And if we need to make a decision or make a call on something, then we do. But again, my culture is very much let the managers do what they've got to do. And then we will push on with developing, growing, taking the business down new paths, but come in when we need to come in. And then there's the all hands room. So the all hands room, like I said, there's the communication to everybody, like we're talking about with sustainability and environment. And it's telling everybody, this is what we're doing. This is what we're trying to achieve. This is where we're trying to go. Or these are the problems that we've got at the moment. You can see we need your help. In the moment, we're very busy. And over the past 3 months, we've had to put on night shifts. And again, it was having those all hands, just talking to everybody, saying, actually, this is where we are. Is there anybody that can help? Is there anybody that thinks they can change their working patterns? Do you know somebody that's out there? We all know the problems with recruitment at the moment out there. And it's just having that type of, for me, the four-room model works for us and helps us get over those.
That's a really interesting governance model, I must say, just listening to that. And Steve, it'd be good to get your thoughts on that in a second. But from a family-managed business, to hear the way that governance model hangs together for your business and has got you through some incredible challenges, I think that's really good insight for other businesses of your size that might be thinking, how do they plan for an event that we don't know that's coming? But you've got to have a good governance model in place, I think, is your point, isn't it? And to be able to deal with challenges and opportunities as they come up. Do you see similar things in other family businesses, would you say, Steve, or not?
I think that was quite insightful, John, actually, in terms of how inclusive you are. And it reminded me, I went on, one particular exercise for a weekend with the TA. One of the things they came across on that was the sense of, can you help, rather than a very directional, you're going to do this. And I think that was came across in what you said there. And I think if you ask people, you get much better response than if you tell. Sometimes you have to be very directional, but I think in the messaging, that can feel very different, the result and what you're trying to achieve. So I don't think that's common across the businesses that I work with at all, actually. So that's quite insightful.
But there's a lot to learn, isn't there? And I think one of the things that I always say on a daily basis is that we should learn something new every day. And I think that's an important thing to have. And whether that's somebody just come running with an idea or somebody just giving you a level of information, because you get to a certain size and where we've grown from, and you're sat going, well, I don't see everything. And somebody would say, you're supposed to see everything, but we don't see everything. We can't see everything. And so unless you've got that communication or you've got that relationship, you're not going to see what's going on. And then sometimes it's too late and the problems hit you. As if you've got the communication, those meetings going on with your teams, you should get feedback or flow or communication. I don't get me wrong, sometimes it doesn't always work like that, but it gives you at least a foothold to me and a step in the right direction to help and get ideas from people. Yes. Because we don't know everything. And as I say, leadership can be a lonely position. And I think it's important that you take counsel, but then you can make a final call if you need to.
I think very, very wise words. Thank you, John. One of the other areas that we have to talk about and get your views on, because it comes up in all of our client discussions as a common topic, is what does the immediate future look like? You know, what's your views on the outlook, on the economy? How are you feeling? How optimistic are you feeling about the outlook for the rest of this year and into next year? Because we read plenty of media headlines, which may not always be the complete picture, but for some of these that at the sharp end, on the ground, and involved in some really quite interesting supply chains, what's your view and your outlook?
I think at the moment, if you actually step back and look at it, we are in a macroeconomic environment, which is a struggle. I think that there is a lot of geopolitical issues in the world. There is obviously the inflationary issues going on in the world. And I think it's easy to then bandy around, like you said, the word recession. We entered this year thinking it wasn't going to be a fun year, and we've just come out of two not fun years. But I will say that I am surprised the way this year is run so far. We are busy. We see customers very busy. We see customers with long order books. Now, that's not to say that there aren't dips. When we work closely with the customers, and we can see that they're saying they've got supply chain issues, which may knock some of their orders, but they're very much saying, we got to work together on this. We are going to be busy towards quarter four, if not start of 24, and 24, 25, and 26 look busy. Now, that's a situation we've never been in before. We were pretty much always month to month, but we certainly see some long-term green shoots, should I say. And now, that doesn't mean something else can't happen. We're not so that naive, but we are certainly building and investing for the future. But cautiously, we still follow the word, you know, cash is still king. We've still got to monitor the business that way. But we certainly see opportunities for growth in the long term, and we're gearing up to work that way. And as I say, from a customer's point of view, and all of our customers are big global branded businesses in their own market sectors, we aren't hearing doom and gloom at this stage at all.
And that's really encouraging to hear. And I would echo that. We're very similar perspective ourselves in Barclays. And, you know, long may that continue. As you say, we've got to be cautious about it. We've got to be sensible. But certainly there's a general sentiment of confidence underlying it, with some challenges, of course, as you say. Another aspect to be interested in, both yours and Steve's views on, actually, is supply chains. Well, I feel and hear when I go around and see many clients around the UK, the supply chain pressure in general seems to have abated, seems to have eased. There's still hot spots, of course, but it seems to be a lot better. And if I went back 12 months ago, it was the number one issue, supply chains. But you mentioned a few moments ago, staff recruitment. Now, that's something we do hear is still a common challenge. So just maybe first, John, your perspective, is that something that's a real issue for the business? And do you see it getting easier anytime soon? Because you're growing, aren't you? Your staff base is growing all the time.
Yeah, certainly even this year we've changed. You asked me how many people work and I said 120 at the moment, but it would have changed last week. We would have taken on X number of people. It is difficult, yes. Well, we're using various methods in media and in agencies and in everything to try and get people. Now, we've got a certain skill set we need, which isn't necessarily straightforward. So we have to change the way we do things. We have to offer apprenticeships with local colleges. We have to change the way that our teams work, to multifunction teams, to move people around different machinery, work in different areas. So it certainly is one of the things that it's a key focus from a board level down is how we're going to keep attracting the right people and how we need to fill those gaps. And to be honest, right at this stage, I don't know how that will work. We do what we do and we're finding people, but it's certainly not easy. And you get people 1 week and the next week, they're not here. And that's the reality of what we're dealing with, which is putting up wage inflation, which in itself is putting up inflation. We're just in this circle at the moment.
I think, look, if Stephen, myself's banking or podcast careers fail, if you've got a couple of apprentice openings and you're willing to have us, we'd be delighted to come and help you out. But Steve, from your perspective, you speak to a lot of clients in the Bristol area and Southwest more generally. Yep. What are you hearing around recruitment? What's the themes, trends?
So availability of labour, the cost of labour, and across the skill set, really, from manual labour through to highly skilled people, there are shortages right across. The pressure in terms of price or cost of that is another issue. Again, reliability, some people come and then last a week and then go. It's been, for certain clients, the most constricting factor in their recovery from the impact of the pandemic. They were thinking, as they went into it, will my market still be there when I come out of it? The market is there, has increased in some instances, but they cannot meet the demand, mainly because of the availability of labour, which is a disappointing factor. The other side I'm seeing is what have been maybe traditional heavy industries, which have been predominantly recruiting from a male audience, are now actually starting to widen the gap and try and make it more attractive for women to come into those industries, because historically they've sort of limited themselves to 50% of the population. So that's a new thinking coming in to say how we can attract women into industries which have predominantly been male orientated in the past.
Well, we've certainly actually changed one of our models for that. So where we've gone into a 3-shift system on certain areas in the factory, we have put out local adverts to mothers who may have school-aged children that might want to work certain hours or come in for flexi time. Because again, we see that as a way of just finding a local pool of resource to come in and just help.
So I think it's just being innovative in terms of the way you're looking at your recruitment, looking at all angles.
That's good to get that insight. Thank you, Steve. Thanks again, John, for some fantastic insight into the dynamics of your family business. Before we finish, I just wanted to ask you a few quick fire questions, if I may. And the first thing I wanted to put to you is, what advice would you give your younger self? And we've heard that you had a career in London and in marketing, and now you're in this family business. But what advice would have you given your younger self now?
I always follow a quote from a movie called Ferris Bueller.
Oh, that's one of my favourite films, yeah.
So life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. And that's the advice that I live by now and would give my younger self still. Life is moving. Technology is moving this world so fast, but sometimes you just got to take a step and look at today, live in that moment, live that day as if it's the new day, and just make a difference and have some fun along the way.
That's very, very wise words. And my follow-on question, if I may, add to that is, I know you've got teenage children. I'm sure you are giving them that advice. The question is, are they listening to that advice, do you think? What are the chances?
No, Bruno.
No, there we are. Good. So some things are quite normal, but some things don't change. And then if you were starting out again, what would your dream job be?
I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So in a way, this is a dream job for me. And I guess why I said 2 years and I'm still here, because even though you're in a family business, I'm every day, I can be as entrepreneurial as I like. So from that point of view, that's great. My only change or focus, and I guess it's where I'm going now, would be down that climate science, renewable energy, but I wasn't aware of it when I was at young or maybe at university, naively, but now I would certainly have more of a focus from the start into those areas.
No, that's really interesting to hear. And my final question for you, which might be linked to that point, is what's the biggest opportunity you think you've taken in your professional life?
Biggest opportunity and risk was joining Gordano.
Yeah. And moving to a porter cabin.
Yeah. From a beautiful office to a porter cabin. But seeing where we've developed and how we've done that, if you could see the building now and where we are and where we're going, then that's, the best opportunity.
Well, congratulations again. Fantastic to hear that story for you personally, but also for the family and the family business. And as you said earlier as well, what I think's impactful and I hear is the impact it's had on your colleagues in the business, the staff members, and the difference that that's made to them as well. So many congratulations again on all of your success and all of your growth. And thank you again for joining us today. We do appreciate your time.
No, thank you.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us to receive notifications of new episodes as they go live. For more insights or to find out how we can support your business, go to barclayscorporate.com. Copyright Barclays Corporate Banking, all rights reserved. Terms and conditions available at barclayscorporate.com.